He went back into the deserted bullpen and looked at the sprung trap lying on its side by John's desk. He picked it up and went over to his own desk. He put the trap inside the gift box and put it in the top drawer of his desk. He took his aspirin out of the lower drawer and shook three of them into his mouth. Then he got the tissue paper, the wrapping paper, the ribbon, and the bow. These he stuffed into the trash basket, covering them with balls of discarded paper. He had no intention of telling Alan or anyone else about the nasty trick Buster had played on him. They wouldn't laugh, but Norris knew what they would think, or thought he did. Only Norris Ridgwick would fall for something like that. Stuck his hand right into a loaded rat trap. Can you believe it? It must be your secret lover. Mr. Keaton was by tonight. Maybe it's a kiss and make-up present. I'll take care of this myself, Norris said in a low, grim voice. He was holding his wounded hand against his chest, in my own way and in my own time. Suddenly a new and urgent thought came to him. What if Buster hadn't been content with the rat trap, which, after all, might not have worked? What if he had gone up to Norris's house? The Basin fishing rod was there, and it wasn't even locked up. He had just leaned it in the corner of the shed next to his creel. What if Buster knew about it and had decided to break it in two? If he did that, I'd break him in two, Norris said. He spoke in a low, angry growl Henry Payton, nor many of his other law enforcement colleagues, for that matter, would not have recognized. He forgot all about locking up when he left the office. He had even temporarily forgotten about the pain in his hand. The only thing that mattered was getting home and making sure the Basin rod was still all right. The shape under the blankets didn't move when Alan eased into the room, and he thought Polly was asleep, probably with the help of a Percodan at bedtime. He undressed quietly and slid into bed beside her. As his head settled on the pillow, he saw that her eyes were open, watching him. It gave him a momentary start, and he jerked. What stranger comes to this maiden's bed? She asked softly. Only I, he replied, smiling a little. This one is in sorrow for waking you, maiden. I was awake, she said, and put her arms around his neck. He slipped his own about her waist. The deep bed warmth of her pleased him. She was like a sleepy furnace. He felt something hard against his chest for a moment, and it almost registered that she was wearing something under her cotton nightgown. Then it shifted, tumbling down between her left breast and her armpit on its fine silver chain. Are you okay? He asked her. She pressed the side of her face against his cheek, still holding him. He could feel her hands locked together at the nape of his neck. No, she said. The word came out in a trembling sigh, and then she began to sob. He held her while she cried, stroking her hair. Why didn't she tell me what that woman was doing, Alan? Polly asked at last. She drew away from him a little. Now his eyes had adjusted to the dark, and he could see her face. Dark eyes, dark hair, white skin. I don't know, he said. If she'd told me, I would have taken care of it. I would have gone to see Wilma Jurzik myself, and... It was not the moment to tell her that Nettie had apparently played the game with almost as much vigor and malice as Wilma herself. Nor was it the moment to tell her that there came a time when the Nettie Cobbs of the world, and the Wilma Jurziks too, he supposed, could no longer be fixed. There came a time when they went beyond anyone's ability to repair. It's 3:30 in the morning, he said. That's a bad time to talk about should-haves and would-haves. He hesitated for a moment before speaking again. According to John LaPointe, Nettie said something to you about Wilma this morning, yesterday morning now. What was it? Polly thought it over. Well, I didn't know it was about Wilma, not then anyway. Nettie brought over a lasagna, and my hands were really bad. She saw it right away. Nettie may have been, I don't know, vague about some things, but I couldn't hide a thing from her. She loved you very much, Alan said gravely, and this brought on a fresh spate of sobbing. He had known it would, just as he knew that some tears have to be cried no matter what the hour. Until they are, they simply rave and burn inside. After a while, Polly was able to go on. Her hands crept back around Alan's neck as she spoke. She got those stupid thermal gloves out. Only this time they really seemed to help. The current crisis seems to have passed anyway. And then she made coffee. I asked her if she didn't have things to do at home, and she said she didn't. She said Raider was on guard, and then she said something like, I think she'll leave me alone anyway. I haven't seen her or heard from her, so I guess she finally got the message. That isn't exact, Alan, but it's pretty close. What time did she come by? Around 10:15. It might have been a little earlier or a little later, but not much. Why, Alan? Does it mean anything? When Alan slid between the sheets, he felt that he would be asleep 10 seconds after his head hit the pillow. Now he was wide awake again and thinking hard. No, he said after a moment. I don't think it means anything except that Nettie had Wilma on her mind. I just can't believe it. She seemed so much better. She really did. Remember me telling you about how she got up the courage to go into Needful Things all on her own last Thursday? Yes. She released him and rolled fretfully onto her back. Alan heard a small metallic chink as she did so, and again thought nothing of it. His mind was still examining what Polly had just told him, turning it this way and that, like a jeweler examining a suspect stone. I'll have to make the funeral arrangements, she said. Nettie has got people in Yarmouth, a few anyway, but they didn't want to have anything to do with her when she was alive, and they'll want to have even less to do with her now that she's dead, but I'll have to call them in the morning. Will I be able to go into Nettie's house, Alan? I think she had an address book. I'll bring you. You won't be able to take anything away, at least not until Dr. Ryan has published his autopsy findings, but I can't see the harm in letting you copy down a few telephone numbers. Thank you. A sudden thought occurred to him. Polly, what time did Nettie leave here? 10:45, I guess. It might have been as late as 11:00. She didn't stay a whole hour, I don't think. Why? Nothing, he said. He'd had a momentary flash. If Nettie had stayed long enough at Polly's, she might not have had time to go back home, find her dog dead, collect the rocks, write the notes, attach them to the rocks, go over to Wilma's and break the windows. But if Nettie had left Polly's house at 10:45, that gave her better than 2 hours, plenty of time. Hey, Alan! The voice, the falsely cheery one that usually restricted its input to the subject of Annie and Todd, spoke up. How come you're trying to bitch this up for yourself, good buddy? And Alan didn't know. There was something else he didn't know either. How had Nettie gotten that load of rocks over to the Jurzik house in the first place? She had no driver's license and didn't have a clue about operating a car. Cut the crap, good buddy, the voice advised. She wrote the notes at her house, probably right down the hall from her dog's dead body, and got the rubber bands from her own kitchen drawer. She didn't have to carry the rocks. There were plenty of those in Wilma's backyard garden, right? Right. Yet he could not get rid of the idea that the rocks had been brought with the notes already attached. He had no concrete reason to think so, but it just seemed right. The kind of thing you'd expect from a kid or someone who thought like a kid. Someone like Nettie Cobb. Quit it. Let it go. He couldn't, though. Polly touched his cheek. I'm awfully glad you came, Alan. It must have been a horrible day for you, too. I've had better, but it's over now. You should let it go, too. Get some sleep. You have a lot of arrangements to make tomorrow. Do you want me to get you a pill? No. My hands are a little better, at least. Alan? She broke off, but stirred restlessly under the covers. What? Nothing, she said. It wasn't important. I think I can sleep now that you're here. Good night. Good night, honey. She rolled away from him, pulled the covers up, and was still. For a moment he thought of how she had hugged him, the feel of her hands locked about his neck. If she was able to flex her fingers enough to do that, then she really was better. That was a good thing, maybe the best thing that had happened to him since Clut had phoned during the football game. If only things would stay better. Polly had a slightly deviated septum, and now she began to snore lightly, a sound Alan actually found rather pleasant. It was good to be sharing a bed with another person, a real person who made real sounds, and sometimes filched the covers. He grinned in the dark. Then his mind turned back to the murders, and the grin faded. I think she'll leave me alone anyway. I haven't seen her or heard from her, so I guess she finally got the message. I haven't seen her or heard from her. I guess she finally got the message. A case like this one didn't need to be solved. Even Seat Thomas could have told you exactly what had happened after a single look at the crime scene through his trifocals. It had been kitchen implements instead of dueling pistols at dawn, but the result was the same. Two bodies in the morgue at KVH with autopsy Y cuts in them. The only question was why it had happened. He had had a few questions, a few vague disquiets, but they would no doubt have blown away before Wilma and Nettie had been seen into the ground. Now the disquiets were more urgent, and some of them, I guess she finally got the message, had names. To Alan, a criminal case was like a garden surrounded by a high wall. You had to get in, so you looked for the gate. Sometimes there were several, but in his experience, there was always at least one. Of course there was. If not, how had the gardener entered to sow the seeds in the first place? It might be large, with an arrow pointing to it and a flashing neon sign reading, "Enter here." Or it might be small and covered with so much ivy that you had to hunt for quite a while before you found it. But it was always there. And if you hunted long enough and weren't afraid of raising a few blisters on your hands from tearing away the overgrowth, you always found it. Sometimes the gate was a piece of evidence found at a crime scene. Sometimes it was a witness. Sometimes it was an assumption firmly based on events and logic. The assumptions he'd made in this case were, 1, that Wilma had been following a long-established pattern of harassment and fuckery. 2, that this time she had chosen the wrong person with whom to play mind games. 3, that Nettie had snapped again, as she had when she killed her husband. But I haven't seen her or heard from her. If Nettie had really said that, how much did it change? How many assumptions did that single sentence knock into cocked hats? Alan didn't know. He stared into the darkness of Polly's bedroom and wondered if he'd found the gate after all. Maybe Polly hadn't heard what Nettie had said correctly. It was technically possible, but Alan didn't believe it. Nettie's actions, at least up to a certain point, supported what Polly claimed to have heard. Nettie hadn't come to work at Polly's on Friday. She'd said she was ill. Maybe she was, or maybe she was just scared of Wilma. That made sense. They knew from Pete Jerzyk that Wilma, after discovering that her sheets had been vandalized, had made at least one threatening call to Nettie. She might have made others the next day that Pete didn't know about. But Nettie had come to see Polly with a gift of food on Sunday morning. Would she have done that if Wilma was still stoking the fires? Alan didn't think so. Then there was the matter of the rocks which had been thrown through Wilma's windows. Each of the attached notes said the same thing. I told you to leave me alone. This is your last warning. A warning usually means that the person being warned has more time to change his or her ways, but time had been up for Wilma and Nettie. They had met on that street corner only 2 hours after the rocks had been thrown. He supposed he could get around that one if he had to. When Nettie found her dog, she would have been furious. Ditto Wilma when she got home and saw the damage to her house. All it would have taken to strike the final spark was a single telephone call. One of the two women had made that call, and the balloon had gone up. Alan turned over on his side, wishing that these were the old days when you could still obtain records of local calls. If he could have documented the fact that Wilma and Nettie had spoken before their final meeting, he would have felt a lot better. Still, take the final phone call as a given. That still left the notes themselves. This is how it must have happened, he thought. Nettie comes home from Polly's and finds her dog dead on the hall floor. She reads the note on the corkscrew. Then she writes the same message on 14 or 16 sheets of paper and puts them in the pocket of her coat. She also gets a bunch of rubber bands. When she gets to Wilma's, she goes into the backyard. She piles up 14 or 16 rocks and uses the elastic bands to attach the notes. She must have done all that prior to throwing any rocks. It would have taken too long if she had to stop in the middle of the festivities to pick out more rocks and attach more notes. And when she's done, she goes home and broods over her dead pet some more. It felt all wrong to him. It felt really lousy. It presupposed a chain of thought and action that just didn't fit what he knew of Nettie Cobb. The murder of her husband had been the outcome of long cycles of abuse, but the murder itself had been an impulse crime committed by a woman whose sanity had been broken. If the records in George Bannerman's old files were correct, Nettie sure hadn't written Albion Cobb any warning notes beforehand. What felt right to him was much simpler. Nettie comes home from Polly's. She finds her dog dead in the hallway. She gets a cleaver from the kitchen drawer and heads up the street to cut herself a wide slice of Polish butt. But if that was the case, who had broken Wilma Jurzik's windows? Plus, the times are all so weird, he muttered, and rolled restlessly over onto his other side. John LaPointe had been with the CIU team, which had spent Sunday afternoon and evening tracing Nettie's movements, what movements there had been. She had gone to Polly's with the lasagna. She told Polly that she would probably go by the new shop, Needful Things, on her way home and speak to the owner, Leland Gaunt, if he was in. Polly said Mr. Gaunt had invited her to look at an item that afternoon, and Nettie was going to tell Mr. Gaunt that Polly would probably show up, even though her hands were paining her quite badly. If Nettie had gone into Needful Things, if Nettie had spent some time there, browsing, talking to the new shopkeeper that everyone in town thought was so fascinating and whom Alan kept not meeting, that might have bitched up her window of opportunity and reopened the possibility of a mystery rock thrower. But she hadn't. The shop had been closed. Gaunt had told both Polly, who had indeed dropped by later on, and the CID boys that he had seen neither hide nor hair of Nettie since the day she came in and bought her carnival glass lampshade. In any case, he had spent the morning in the back room, listening to classical music and cataloging items. If someone had knocked, he probably wouldn't have heard anyway. So Nettie must have gone directly home, and that left her time to do all those things which Alan found so unlikely. Wilma Jurzik's window of opportunity was even narrower. Her husband had some woodworking equipment in the basement. He had been down there Sunday morning from 8 until just past 10. He saw it was getting late, he said, so he'd shut down the machinery and gone upstairs to dress for 11 o'clock mass. Wilma, he told the officers, had been in the shower when he entered the bedroom, and Alan had no reason to doubt the new widower's testimony. It must have gone like this. Wilma leaves her house on a drive-by mission at 9:35 or 9:40. Pete's in the basement making birdhouses or whatever and doesn't even know she's gone. Wilma gets to Nettie's at about 9:45, just minutes after Nettie must have left for Polly's, and sees the door standing open. To Wilma, this is as good as a gilt-edged invitation. She parks, goes inside, kills the dog, and writes the note on impulse, and leaves again. None of the neighbors remembered seeing Wilma's bright yellow Yugo. Inconvenient, but hardly proof it hadn't been there. Most of the neighbors had been gone anyway, either to church or visiting out of town. Wilma drives back to her house, goes upstairs while Pete is shutting down his planer or jigsaw or whatever, and gets undressed. When Pete enters the master bathroom to wash the sawdust off his hands before putting on a coat and tie, Wilma has just stepped into the shower. In fact, she's probably still dry on one side. Pete Jurzik's finding his wife in the shower was the only thing in the whole mess that made perfect sense to Alan. The corkscrew which had been used on the dog was a lethal enough weapon, but a short one. She'd have wanted to wash off any bloodstains on her hands and arms. Wilma just misses Nettie on one end, and just misses her husband on the other. Was it possible? Yes, only by a squeak and a gasp, but it was possible. So let it go, Alan. Let it go and go to sleep. But he still couldn't, because it still sucked. It sucked hard. Alan rolled onto his back once more. Downstairs, he heard the clock in the living room softly chiming 4. This was getting him nowhere at all, but he couldn't seem to turn his mind off. He tried to imagine Nettie sitting patiently at her kitchen table, writing, "This is your last warning," over and over again, while, less than 20 feet away, her beloved little dog lay dead. He couldn't seem to do it, no matter how he tried. What had seemed like a gate into this particular garden now seemed more and more like a clever painting of a gate on a high, unbroken wall. A trompe l'oeil. Had Nettie stalked over to Wilma's house on Willow Street and broken the windows? He didn't know, but he did know that Nettie Cobb was still a figure of interest in Castle Rock, the crazy lady who had killed her husband and then spent all those years in Juniper Hill. On the rare occasions when she deviated from the path of her usual routine, she was noticed. If she had gone stalking over to Willow Street on Sunday morning, perhaps muttering to herself as she went and almost certainly crying, she would have been noticed. Tomorrow, Alan would start knocking on the doors between the two houses and asking questions. He began to slip off to sleep at last. The image that followed him down was a pile of rocks with a sheet of notepaper banded around each one. And he thought again, if Nettie didn't throw them, then who did? As the small hours of Monday morning crept toward dawn and the beginning of a new and interesting week, a young man named Ricky Bissonette emerged from the hedge surrounding the Baptist parsonage. Inside this neat-as-a-pin building, the Reverend William Rose slept the sleep of the just and the righteous. Ricky, 19 and not overburdened with brains, worked down at Sunny Sunoco. He had closed up hours ago, but had hung around in the office, waiting until it was late enough, or early enough, to play a little prank on Reverend Rose. On Friday afternoon, Ricky had stopped by the new shop and had fallen into conversation with the proprietor, who was one interesting old fellow. One thing led to another, and at some point, Ricky had realized he was telling Mr. Gaunt his deepest, most secret wish. He had mentioned the name of a young actress model, a very young actress model, and told Mr. Gaunt he would give just about anything for some pictures of this young woman with her clothes off. "You know, I have something that might interest you," Mr. Gaunt had said. He glanced around the store as if to verify that it was empty except for the two of them, then went to the door and turned the open sign over to closed. He returned to his spot by the cash register, rummaged under the counter, and came up with an unmarked manila envelope. "Have a look at these, Mr. Bissonette," Mr. Gaunt said, and then dropped a rather lecherous man-of-the-world wink. "I think you'll be startled, perhaps even amazed." Stunned was more like it. It was the actress model for whom Ricky lusted. It had to be, and she was a lot more than just nude. In some of the pictures, she was with a well-known actor. In others, she was with two well-known actors, one of whom was old enough to be her grandfather. And in still others... But before he could see any of the others, and it appeared there were 50 or more, all brilliant 8x10 glossy color shots, Mr. Gaunt snatched them away. "That's..." Ricky gulped, mentioning a name which was well known to readers of the glossy tabloids and watchers of the glossy talk shows. "Oh, no," Mr. Gaunt said, while his jade-colored eyes said, "Oh, yes. I'm sure it can't be, but the resemblance is remarkable, isn't it? The sale of pictures such as these is illegal, of course. Sexual content aside, the girl can't be a minute over 17, whoever she is. But I might be persuaded to deal for these just the same, Mr. Bissonette. The fever in my blood is not malaria, but commerce. So, shall we dicker?" They dickered. Ricky Bissonette ended up purchasing 72 pornographic photographs for $36 and this little prank. He ran across the parsonage lawn, bent over at the waist, settled into the shadow of the porch for a moment to make sure he was unwatched, then climbed the steps. He produced a plain white card from his back pocket, opened the mail slot, and dropped the card through. He eased the brass slot closed with the tips of his fingers, not wanting it to clack shut. Then he vaulted the porch railing and ran fleetly back across the lawn. He had big plans for the 2 or 3 hours of darkness which still remained to this Monday morning. They involved 72 photographs and a large bottle of Jergens hand lotion. The card looked like a white moth as it fluttered from the mail slot to the faded rug runner in the front hall of the parsonage. It landed message side up. "How you doing, you stupid Baptist rat fuck? We are writing you to say you better quit talking out against our casino night. We are just going to have a little fun. We are not hurting you. Anyway, a bunch of us loyal Catholics are tired of your Baptist bullshit. We know all you Baptists are a bunch of cunt lickers anyway. Now to this you better pay attention, Reverend Steamboat Willie. If you don't keep your dick face out of our business, we are going to stink you and your ass-face buddies up so bad you will stink forever. Leave us alone, you stupid Baptist rat fuck, or you will be one sorry son of a bitch. Just a warning from the concerned Catholic men of Castle Rock." Reverend Rose discovered the note when he came downstairs in his bathrobe to collect the morning paper. His reaction is perhaps better imagined than described. Leland Gaunt stood at the window of the front room above Needful Things with his hands clasped behind his back, looking out across the town of Castle Rock. The four-room apartment behind him would have raised eyebrows in town, for there was nothing in it. Nothing at all. Not a bed, not an appliance, not a single chair. The closet stood open and empty. A few dust bunnies tumbled lazily across floors innocent of rugs in a slight draft that blew through the place at ankle level. The only furnishings were, quite literally, window dressing, homey checked curtains. They were the only furnishings which mattered, because they were the only things which could be seen from the street. The town was sleeping now. The shops were dark, the houses were dark, and the only movement on Main Street was the blinker at the intersection of Main and Laurel, flashing on and off in sleepy yellow beats. He looked over the town with a tender, loving eye. It wasn't his town just yet, but it soon would be. He had a lien on it already. They didn't know that, but they would. They would. The grand opening had gone very, very well. Mr. Gaunt thought of himself as an electrician of the human soul. In a small town like Castle Rock, all the fuse boxes were lined up neatly side by side. What you had to do was open the boxes and then start cross-wiring. You hot-wired a Wilma Jurzik to a Nettie Cobb by using wires from two other fuse boxes, those of a young fellow like Brian Rusk and a drunk fellow like Hugh Priest, let us say. You hot-wired other people in the same way, a Buster Keaton to a Norris Ridgwick, a Frank Jewett to a George Nelson, a Sally Ratcliffe to a Lester Pratt. At some point, you tested one of your fabulous wiring jobs just to make sure everything was working correctly, as he had done today, and then you laid low and sent an occasional charge through the circuits every once in a while to keep things interesting, to keep things hot. But mostly you just laid low until everything was done, and then you turned on the juice, all the juice, all at once. All it took was an understanding of human nature and, of course, it's really a question of supply and demand, Leland Gaunt mused, as he looked out over the sleeping town. And why? Well, just because, actually. Just because. People always thought in terms of souls, and of course he would take as many of those as he could when he closed up shop. They were to Leland Gaunt what trophies were to the hunter, what stuffed fish were to the fisherman. They were worth little to him these days in any practical sense, but he still bagged his limit if he possibly could, no matter what he might say to the contrary. To do any less would not be playing the game. Yet it was mostly amusement, not souls, that really kept him going. Simple amusement. It was the only reason that mattered after a while, because when the years were long, you took diversion where you could find it. Mr. Gaunt took his hands from behind his back, those hands which revolted anyone unlucky enough to feel their crepitant touch, and locked them together tightly, the knuckles of his right hand pressing into the palm of his left, the knuckles of his left pressing into the palm of his right. His fingernails were long and thick and yellow. They were also very sharp, and after a moment or two they cut into the skin of his fingers, bringing a blackish-red flow of thick blood. Brian Rusk cried out in his sleep. Myra Evans thrust her hands into the fork of her crotch and began to masturbate furiously. In her dream, the king was making love to her. Danforth Keaton dreamed he was lying in the middle of the home stretch at Lewiston Raceway, and he covered his face with his hands as the horses bore down on him. Sally Ratcliffe dreamed she opened the door of Lester Pratt's Mustang, only to see it was full of snakes. Hugh Priest screamed himself awake from a dream in which Henry Beaufort, the bartender at the Mellow Tiger, poured lighter fluid all over his foxtail and set it on fire. Everett Frankel, Ray Van Allen's physician's assistant, dreamed he slipped his new pipe into his mouth, only to discover that the stem had turned into a razor blade and he had cut off his own tongue. Polly Chalmers began to moan softly, and inside the small silver charm she wore, something stirred and moved, with a rustling like the whir of small, dusty wings, and it sent up a faint, dusty aroma, like a tremor of violets. Leland Gaunt relaxed his grip slowly. His big, crooked teeth were exposed in a grin which was both cheerful and surpassingly ugly. All over Castle Rock, dreams blew away, and uneasy sleepers rested easy once more. For now. Soon, the sun would be up. Not long after that, a new day would begin with all its surprises and wonders. He believed the time had come to hire an assistant. Not that the assistant would be immune to the process which he had now set in motion. Heavens, no. That would spoil all the fun. Leland Gaunt stood at the window and looked at the town below, spread out, defenseless, in all that lovely darkness. Monday, the 14th of October, Columbus Day, dawned fair and hot in Castle Rock. The residents grumbled about the heat, and when they met in groups, on the town common, at Nan's, on the benches in front of the municipal building, they told each other it was unnatural. Probably had something to do with the goddamn Iraqis, they said, or maybe that hole in the ozone layer they were always blabbering about on TV. Several of the old-timers declared it was never 70 degrees at 7 o'clock in the morning during the second week of October when they were young. This wasn't true, of course, and most, if not all of them, knew it. Every 2 or 3 years, you could count on Indian summer to get a little out of hand, and there would be 4 or 5 days that felt like the middle of July. Then one morning you'd wake up with what felt like a summer cold, only to see the front lawn stiff with frost and a snow flurry or two breezing around in the chilly air. They knew all this, but as a topic of conversation, the weather was simply too good to ruin by acknowledging it. No one wanted to argue. Arguments, when the weather turned unseasonably hot, were not a good idea. People were apt to get ugly, and if Castle Rock residents wanted a sobering example of what could happen when people got ugly, they only had to look as far as the intersection of Willow and Ford Streets. Those two women had it coming. Lenny Partridge, the town's oldest resident and premier gossip, opined as he stood on the steps of the Bandbox County Courthouse, which took up the west wing of the municipal building. Both of them crazy and a pair of rats in a backed-up shithouse. That Cobb woman stuck a meat fork in her husband, you know. Lenny hitched at the truss beneath his baggy trousers. Stuck him just like a pig, she did. Hot damn, ain't some women crazy? He looked up at the sky and added, hot like this, there's apt to be more contention. I seen it before. First thing Sheriff Pangborn ought to do is order Henry Beaufort to keep the tiger closed until the weather gets normal again. That's Jake with me, old-timer, Charlie Fortin said. I can get my beer at Hemphill's for a day or two and do my drinking at home. This earned him laughter from the loose knot of men around Lenny and a fierce scowl from Mr. Partridge himself. The group broke up. Most of these men had to work, holiday or no holiday. Already some of the rickety pulp trucks parked in front of Nan's were pulling out, headed for logging operations in Sweden and Nod's Ridge and out by Castle Lake. Danforth Buster Keaton sat in his study, wearing only his underpants. The underpants were soggy. He hadn't left the room since Sunday evening, when he had made a brief trip down to the municipal building. He'd gotten the Bureau of Taxation file and brought it home. Castle Rock's head selectman was oiling his Colt revolver for the third time. At some point this morning, he meant to load it. Then he meant to kill his wife. Then he meant to go down to the municipal building, find that son of a bitch Ridgewick, he had no idea it was Norris's day off, and kill him. Last of all, he intended to lock himself in his office and kill himself. He had decided that the only way he could escape the persecutors forever was by taking these steps. He had been a fool to think otherwise. Not even a board game which magically picked winners at the racetrack could stop them. Oh, no. He had learned that lesson yesterday when he had come home to find those terrible pink slips taped up all over the house. The telephone on the desk rang. Startled, Keaton squeezed the Colt's trigger. There was a dry snap. If the gun had been loaded, he would have put a bullet spang through the study door. He scooped the phone up. "Can't you people leave me alone even for a little while?" he shouted angrily. The quiet voice which replied silenced him at once. It was the voice of Mr. Gaunt, and it poured over Keaton's blistered soul like soothing balm. "What luck did you have with the toy I sold you, Mr. Keaton?" "It worked," Keaton said. His voice was jubilant. He forgot, at least for the moment, that he was planning a strenuous morning of murder and suicide. "I collected on every race, by God!" "Well, that's fine," Mr. Gaunt said warmly. Keaton's face clouded again. His voice dropped to what was almost a whisper. "Then, yesterday, when I got home..." He found he could not go on. A moment later, he discovered, to his great amazement and even greater delight, that he didn't have to. "You discovered they had been in your house?" Mr. Gaunt asked.
"Yes, yes! How did you know—"
"They are everywhere in this town," Mr. Gaunt said. "I told you that when last we met, did I not?"
"Yes, and—"
Keaton broke off suddenly, his face twisted in alarm. "They could have this line tapped. Do you realize that, Mr. Gaunt? They could be listening in on our conversation right now." Mr. Gaunt remained calm. "They could, but they are not. Please don't think I am naive, Mr. Keaton. I have encountered them before, many times. I'm sure you have, Keaton said. He was discovering that the wild joy he had taken in winning ticket was little or nothing compared to this, to finding, after what felt like centuries of struggle and darkness, a kindred soul. But I have a small electronic device attached to my line, Mr. Gaunt went on in his calm and mellow voice. If the line is tapped, a small light goes on. I am looking at that light now, Mr. Keaton, and it is dark as some of the hearts in this town.
You do know, don't you?
Danforth Keaton said in a fervent, trembling voice. He felt as if he might weep. Yes, and I called to tell you that you mustn't do anything rash, Mr. Keaton. The voice was soft, lulling. As he listened to it, Keaton felt his mind begin to drift away like a child's helium-filled balloon. That would make things far too easy for them. Why, do you realize what would happen if you were to die? No, Keaton murmured. He was looking out the window. His eyes were blank and dreamy. They would have a party, Mr. Gaunt cried softly. They would get liquored up in Sheriff Pangborn's office. They would go out to Homeland Cemetery and urinate on your grave. Sheriff Pangborn? Keaton said uncertainly. You don't really believe a drone like Deputy Ridgewick is allowed to operate in a case like this without orders from his higher-ups, do you? No, of course not. He was beginning to see more clearly now. They. It had always been they, a tormenting dark cloud around him, and when you snatched at that cloud, you came away with nothing. Now he at last began to understand that they had faces and names. They might even be vulnerable. Knowing this was a tremendous relief. Pangborn, Fullerton, Samuels, the Williams woman, your own wife. They are all part of it, Mr. Keaton, but I suspect, yes, and rather strongly, that Sheriff Pangborn is the ringleader. If so, he would love it if you killed one or two of his underlings and then put yourself out of the way. Why, I suspect that is exactly what he has been aiming for all along. But you're going to fool him, Mr. Keaton, aren't you? Yes, Keaton whispered fiercely. What should I do? Nothing today. Go about your business as usual. Go to the races tonight, if you like, and enjoy your new purchase. If you appear the same as always to them, it will throw them off balance. It will sow confusion and uncertainty amidst the enemy. Confusion and uncertainty, Keaton muttered. He thought they were the loveliest words he had ever heard. Yes, I'm laying my own plans, and when the time comes, I'll let you know. Do you promise? Oh, yes, indeed, Mr. Keaton. You are quite important to me. In fact, I would go so far as to say I could not do it without you. Mr. Gaunt rang off. Keaton put his pistol and the gun-cleaning kit away. Then he went upstairs, dumped his soiled clothes into the laundry hamper, showered, and dressed. When he came down, Myrtle shrank away from him at first, but Keaton spoke kindly to her and kissed her cheek. Myrtle began to relax. Whatever the crisis had been, it seemed to have passed. Everett Frankel was a big red-haired man who looked as Irish as County Cork, which was not surprising since it was from Cork that his mother's ancestors had sprung. He had been Ray Van Allen's PA for 4 years, ever since he'd gotten out of the Navy. He arrived at Castle Rock Family Practice at 7:45 that Monday morning, and Nancy Ramage, the head nurse, asked him if he could go right out to the Bergmeier farm. Helen Bergmeier had suffered what might have been an epileptic seizure in the night, she said. If Everett's diagnosis confirmed this, he was to bring her back to town in his car so the doctor, who would be in shortly, could examine her and decide if she needed to go to the hospital for tests. Ordinarily, Everett would have been unhappy to be sent on a house call first thing, especially one so far out in the country. But on an unseasonably hot morning like this, a ride out of town seemed like just the thing. Besides, there was the pipe. Once he was in his Plymouth, he unlocked the glove compartment and took it out. It was a meerschaum, with a bowl both deep and wide. It had been carved by a master craftsman, that pipe. Birds and flowers and vines revolved around the bowl in a pattern that actually seemed to change when one looked at it from different angles. He had left the pipe in the glove compartment, not just because smoking was forbidden in the doctor's office, but because he didn't like the idea of other people, especially a snoop like Nancy Ramage, seeing it. First, they would want to know where he had gotten it. Then they would want to know how much he had paid for it. And some of them might covet it. He put the stem between his teeth, marveling again at how perfectly right it felt there, how perfectly in its place. He tilted down the rearview mirror for a moment so he could see himself and approve completely of what he saw. He thought the pipe made him look older, wiser, handsomer. And when he had the pipe clenched between his teeth, the bowl pointed up a bit at just the right debonair angle, he felt older, wiser, handsomer. He drove down Main Street, meaning to cross the tin bridge between the town and the country, and then slowed as he approached Needful Things. The green awning tugged at him like a fishhook. It suddenly seemed very important, imperative, in fact, that he stop. He pulled in, started to get out of the car, then remembered that the pipe was still clenched between his teeth. He took it out, feeling a small pang of regret as he did so, and locked it in the glove compartment again. This time, he actually reached the sidewalk before returning to the Plymouth to lock all four doors. With a nice pipe like that, it didn't do to take chances. Anybody might be tempted to steal a nice pipe like that. Anybody at all. He approached the shop and then stopped, feeling disappointed. A sign hung in the window. "Closed Columbus Day," it read. Everett was about to turn away when the door opened. Mr. Gaunt stood there, looking resplendent and quite debonair himself, in a fawn-colored jacket with elbow patches and charcoal-gray pants. "Come in, Mr. Frankel," he said. "I'm so glad you could stop by." "Well, I'm on my way out of town to see a lady, and I thought I'd just stop and tell you again how much I like my pipe. I've always wanted one just like that." Beaming, Mr. Gaunt said, "I know, but I see you're closed, so I won't bother you." "I am never closed to my favorite customers, Mr. Frankel, and I put you among that number, high among that number. Step in." And he held out his hand. Everett shrank away from it. Leland Gaunt laughed cheerfully at this and stepped aside so the young physician's assistant could enter. "I really can't stay," Everett began, but he felt his feet carry him forward into the gloom of the shop as if they knew better. "Of course not," Mr. Gaunt said. "The healer must be about his appointed rounds, releasing the chains of illness which bind the body and..." His grin, a thing of raised eyebrows and clenched, jostling teeth, sprang forth. "And driving out those devils which bind the spirit. Am I right?" "I guess so," Everett said. He felt a pang of uneasiness as Mr. Gaunt closed the door. He hoped his pipe would be all right. Sometimes people broke into cars. Sometimes they did that even in broad daylight. "Your pipe will be fine," Mr. Gaunt soothed. From his pocket, he drew a plain envelope with one word written across the front. The word was Lovey. "Do you remember promising to play a little prank for me, Dr. Frankel? I'm not a doc..." Mr. Gaunt's eyebrows drew together in a way that made Everett cease and desist at once. He took half a step backward. "Do you remember, or don't you?" Mr. Gaunt asked sharply. "You'd better answer me quickly, young man. I'm not as sure of that pipe as I was a moment ago." "I remember," Everett said. His voice was hasty and alarmed. "Sally Ratcliffe, the speech teacher." The bunched center of Mr. Gaunt's more or less single eyebrow relaxed. Everett Frankel relaxed with it. "That's right. And the time has come to play that little prank, doctor. Here." He held out the envelope. Everett took it, being careful that his fingers should not touch Mr. Gaunt's as he did so. "Today is a school holiday, but the young Miss Ratcliffe is in her office at the grammar school updating her files," Mr. Gaunt said. "I know that's not on your way to the Bergmeyer farm." "How do you know so much?" Everett asked in a dazed voice. Mr. Gaunt waved this away impatiently. "But you might make time to go by on your way back, yes?" "I suppose. And since outsiders at a grammar school, even when the students aren't there, are regarded with some suspicion, you might explain your presence by dropping by the school nurse's office, yes?" "If she's there, I guess I could do that," Everett said. "In fact, I really should, because..." "You still haven't picked up the kindergarten vaccination records," Mr. Gaunt finished for him. "That's fine. As a matter of fact, she won't be there, but you don't know that, do you? Just poke your head into her office and then leave. But on your way in, or your way out, I want you to put that envelope in the car Miss Ratcliffe has borrowed from her young man. I want you to put it under the driver's seat, but not entirely under. I want you to leave it with just a corner sticking out.